We are at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Today is Saturday, September the 27th, 2014. And thank you, Susie, for coming in to talk to us today about your memories of UAF.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So if you could just state your full name and perhaps where you were born and where you're from, and maybe talk a little bit about your early years first.
Well, I was born in Quincy, Illinois. My name is Sylvia Sue Klingner, but my father took one look at me and said, "That's a Susie." So at the University of Alaska, I was known as Susie Klingner.
Right. And so you were born, I'm sorry, you said you were born in?
Quincy, Illinois.
Quincy, Illinois. So was that a large town when you
were? No, it was not a large town. It was along the Mississippi River, right across from Hannibal, Missouri, Mark Twain area. And my father had his own engineering firm and did a lot of work with flood control. In fact, he wrote a book at one time on his experiences along the Mississippi River. I myself was kind of nomadic from a very early age. I would go down to Little Cedar Creek and follow it, looking for fossils and geodes. And one time I looked up and there was the Mississippi River. I had followed that creek all the way to the Mississippi. So I think, like Cyrus Gordon, I'm a nomad. And I assure you, the one reason I came to Alaska, I had read The Call of the Wild, and I just have a little wild streak in me, so I came.
So how old were you when you came to Alaska then?
I was, let's see, about 19.
And purposely came to go to UAF?
Yes, definitely purposely. I had written for their catalog, and when I read it, I was hooked, for sure. Hooked on Alaska. It was because of the professors that they had there. Dr. Scarland for anthropology. And I had told my father, I want to be a cultural anthropologist. And he said, if you want any help from me, Susie, you've got to take a choice. You have to be a teacher or a nurse. I thought, do I want to clean up vomit? Or do I want to study different cultures? And I can be a teacher and do that. So I came, I met Dr. Scarlin in the most wonderful situation ever. I was never away from home, and I was missing my wonderful grandfather, Shuey. And I was so sad in the commons, and I looked so down. And Dr. Scarlin came over to me, and he said, well, what's wrong, Susie? And I said, oh, Dr. Scarlin, I miss my grandfather so much. And he said, if you'd like, you can call me grandfather. I'll be your grandfather while you're at the university. Well, I admit today, young people, they're probably a little bit more knowledgeable about life than I was when I came here. But I learned it fast up here. I learned it fast. I lived in McIntosh Hall, the most wonderful place to ever be. It was a converted men's dormitory. Lathrop was next to us, and Lathrop boys would come over when the aurora was out, especially if the whole sky was green and gold, and they would play their guitars underneath the windows for us. And some of them would get so rambunctious, they would climb up the walls, and the women students would pull them through the windows. That was back in the time when they locked us in at night. Those doors were locked.
And what year was it that you came to UAF?
62, 63, 63, 64.
Right.
That was my junior and senior year. Now, if I'm going back to my early childhood time, that actually influenced my choice of this university. I went to a little country school, Ellington. It had two rooms, and it was first through fourth and fourth through eighth grade. I love the closeness that you develop between your teacher and you that lasts throughout your life. My grade school teacher wrote to me until the day she died.
And then where did you do your high school?
And so then high school was quite a shocker.
Mm-hmm.
I went from this little grade school to a high school that had 5,000 students. Okay. But I remember the first day of high school there was a young woman lost, and she didn't know how to find her room. I said, well, I'll take you to the right room. And so I took her hand, and I took her right to her room, and she just thanked me, and we became best friends. And here, all these years later, we are still best friends.
Oh, how wonderful.
So that was my experience. So sometimes, you see, I acted like I really knew when maybe I didn't know that much anyway.
But in 1962, the population at UAF must have been quite small, too.
It was very, very small, and I can't tell you exactly how many people were here, but this was the reason why I chose this school. I saw in the catalog that there would be one full professor to every 10 students. Then I read that catalog, and I saw Dr. Michael Krauss, and I thought, linguistics. My speech is so poor. I need help. From Harvard. I thought, I might go there and not spend very much money. Tuition was only $100 at that time for out-of-state students. And after you were here one semester, you were considered an Alaskan, and you did not even have to pay anymore. So I just thought, yes, I'm coming. I'm going to study under Scarlin. I'm going to study under Krauss. And there was Dr. Youngblood, who was Native American. I thought, yes, I will get to do that type of study that I wanted to. And, of course, every professor I had, I have to admit, I just so admired them. Mm-hmm. I really admired them. They gave you so much time. In class and out of class, they would come to the commons and talk to you. You could go to their office. I remember being in Dr. Kong's office for 4 straight hours one time, just conversing with him, and he was helping me understand the different sounds of S's and the like in Korean. And yet I was just amazed. Now, in Dr. Krauss, he taught us Hebrew. We petitioned for him. And this was really funny. Sandra Scott Stringer, Greg Zweibel, I believe his name, Zweibel, and Jacqueline King came to me with a petition and asked me to sign it. And I said, well, what's this for? And they said, well, to get Hebrew taught at this university. I said, well, shouldn't we be studying Athabaskan or Tlingit or Tsimshian or Haida or something else or even Eyak? Because Krauss was doing research on Eyak at that time. And they said, you're our friend. Won't you do this for us? We want Hebrew. I said, okay, I'll do it because you really want to study it, but you have to tell me why you want to study it. And so they told me the reasons why and what they wanted to do in research and the like.
And what were the reasons why?
Well, one thing, and this is not necessarily the path either one of them took, mm-hmm. But they wanted to go to the Middle East and do research and eventually have PhDs. And so I thought, okay, I'll help them with their goal. I signed it, not knowing that that would mean on Sunday for 4 hours, I would be studying Hebrew with Dr. Krauss. I had no idea that that's what it was going to be. But I went in there, and his scholarship was outstanding. And he really cared about us. And he worked one-on-one with us. And here he has this woman from the Midwest, you know, coming in. My ears heard English, if you can call it English, where I lived. And he really helped me to blossom and to grow and to see language in depth and to understand how the structure is put together. And I know at a later time in my life, in Greeley, at what is now the University of Northern Colorado, I wrote a paper on modern noun formation in Israeli Hebrew. So, but without his help, I never could have understood how to do that. And I remember I took a dictionary, and I would just read it, and I'd put all the nouns down, and I'd look to see which form they were in, whether they were like a simple call or a PL, which is an intensive form, or a reflexive form, a hipaleo, or whatever they were. And I figured out in modern Israeli Hebrew, how they were making the language come alive. And 100%, without Dr. Krauss, without his instruction, I never could have done that. This also helped me later in life. I lived in Jerusalem. I studied with Yaakov Meshurer, who was the curator of the Israeli Museum. And I studied archaeology, dug at, you know, the wall. All of this is kind of related to things that I had picked up here. And I would like to say on this tape, thank you, Dr. Krauss. Because, and I must say one thing he told me one time. He brought in Cy Gittin, who later in life, he was in charge of the American Schools of Oriental Research in Jerusalem. He brought him in. He was a chaplain in the Air Force. And he was to teach us how to express ourselves in the spoken language. I like Dr. Krauss. I thought Dr. Gittin, not Dr. Gittin, then Rabbi Gittin, was rather into himself. You know, he had that attitude. And I asked Dr. Krauss one time, I said, Dr. Krauss, I just want so much to study Hebrew with you, but do I really have to learn the spoken with Rabbi Gittin? And he said, Susie, let me be honest with you. Your reading abilities, your written abilities, and your ability to speak a language are the difference between a genius and a fool. So I suggest you come to class and you learn from Cy Gittin. So then I thought, yes. And that was something good to tell me too, because it taught me to be open to things that were difficult for me and to broaden myself. And so, let's say I'm not very verbal. It doesn't matter. Don't be afraid to try. Don't be afraid to make a mistake. Just open your mouth and speak it. So
when you were here, you wanted to do anthropology, but you said that you ended up doing education?
I ended up doing education and taking a really wide variety, like a taste of many different things. I felt you cannot be an effective teacher if you don't know subjects. Mm-hmm. So I must know some math. I must know science. I must know history. And coming from a little country school where one teacher teaches everything made me think, I want a wide variety of studies so that when I relate to children in a classroom, I can find out what is that person's interest. How can I enhance that person's learning ability to make them reach their goals? Each person, his or her own goal. And so I just took a little here. I had experimental psychology. I remember my professor was from Yale. I had a smattering of lots of different things.
And what were you hoping to teach in the end? Were you hoping to just teach
what I was hoping to do? What I was hoping to do was what I initially had said to my father. I want to study cultural anthropology. So, where should I go? University of Alaska? I'm going to be with people from southeastern, you know, Alaska and from farther north and from all these different villages. I am going to be doing cultural anthropology, even though my degree is not going to say that. And I continued doing that when I was in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And in every place that I traveled, you know, with the Aborigines or what have you, when I went to Australia, every place that I went throughout Europe, I visited all different groups of peoples. And so I did, in essence, do what I wanted to do. And if you do what you want to do, you're happy. You're happy.
Mm-hmm. But what age, when you were going through for education, were you thinking, okay, I'll be a high school teacher or an elementary school teacher?
I expected when I went through to do something probably different than most people mm-hmm. would think to do. I decided that I was going to start from the very earliest, and I started in my hometown of Fairgrove, Missouri, preschool story hour, and was the teacher for that. I wanted to go way down before they ever enter school, and I wanted to do the whole range from preschool all the way up through university level. And the way I was able to do the university level was to make my own classroom of professors and graduate students who wanted to learn Hebrew. So then I would instruct them. That way I would have the whole range. And then I also, when I had children, decided not to work full-time, but to sub in every single area. So I subbed. I taught the football players how to do ballet. I mean, I taught gymnastics in several different towns in the evenings, so I would also have physical development. And I taught math, all different kinds of sciences, biological sciences, horticulture, agriculture, any area I wanted it. I subbed in the music departments and the art departments, in three different counties surrounding me. That way, I was able to see what is happening in American education. So, and then I taught a course in Israel as well and lectured in Israel. I attended the most wonderful Ulpan, which is an intensified Hebrew school, in which everyone there was either a visiting professor at Hebrew University or an American diplomat. So, and I gave a lecture on Alaska in Hebrew. And I still remember that because here were these professors from Czechoslovakia and all different places. And I was trying very hard and I was just talking and I wanted to say moose. And I thought, moose? There isn't, I don't know any word for moose in Hebrew. I'm thinking in Hebrew, but I don't know the word for moose. And so I said, a deer with a big nose. And then they said, a deer with a big nose. And they all looked like they didn't understand. So I went over to the board and I drew this great big head of a moose with the antlers and everything. And then I heard everybody, all the professors in their own languages coming up with the name for moose in all these different languages. It was wonderful. I loved it. I loved it. But Alaska has influenced my life. Very much.
What were your first impressions when you got there?
Oh, I was going to tell you, I came in on the plane. First of all, I was so excited. And I had flown over beautiful mountains. And to the summit, you know, that's our motto here. And that's just the way I felt. And when I came in, the birch trees were so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And the yellows everywhere, and the Chena River flowing, and I thought, I'm home, you know, this is just beautiful. And so it came down, and it was like almost being early childhood again, because you had all this enthusiasm for this place, and what it was going to be, and all these little discoveries that maybe I would make here, and all these friendships, and ways to bond with different peoples. I was just filled with, what do you call it, like electrons shooting from me from the aurora borealis or something, and just filling me with this enormous energy and this aura, you know, around, just feeling so happy, you know, to think, what an adventure. So anyway, I landed here and I came. Now, Jane Scheibel was my big sister. She just took me around. She introduced me. introduced me to different students and faculty and people, and she was a tremendous, what you say, the big sister, little sister program. Mm-hmm. I was a junior when I came, but I went to the freshman orientation, and that's where I met those people that got me in the Hebrew class, Jacqueline King and Sandra Scott Stringer. Definitely. And we were close like this for years. In fact, when I was married, Jackie King came to my wedding, which was really nice and such a surprise, you know.
And are they still alive today?
I corresponded with Jackie King until just a couple years ago, and then suddenly I didn't hear. So I am not sure about that. Sandra Stringer, of course, died several years ago. It was very, very hard on me. Bill Stringer called me, and he also sent me, the information about her passing. And Sandra Stringer told me something that was so important to me in my life. I was leaving here, you know, to go out into the world and do my things. And Sandra told me, the way we are going to be bonded is this. You are going to stand wherever you are in the world, and you are going to look up into the sky, and you'll find the North Star. And you look at that North Star, and you will know that I am in Alaska looking up at that North Star, and the two of us are we're sharing the same experience, and we will be bonded for life. Mm-hmm. And I always remember that. And do you know, when you cannot imagine how many times I went out. I live in the country, no houses around me, not lights. I can see the sky beautifully. And I would go out and then stand there, and I would look up and wonder if Sandra Stringer was looking there too.
Yeah. Lovely story.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
And I do want to somehow pay tribute to these people that I knew here. And I want to say that I love the class of 64. Truly love them. Those professors, when we graduated, they stood outside on either side of the sidewalk. And we came out and they applauded. And I thought we should be applauding them. Mm-hmm. They worked so hard for each one of us. Then they had messages that they would write, and they would put a message in the hand of their favorite student. Both my hands were full, and every professor I had given me a message.
Wonderful. And what were some of the messages? Can you remember?
Well, I can remember one of them, which I absolutely love. Uh-huh. I love this one. It said, "You may not have been the most intelligent student I ever had, but you were the most loved." And I loved that.
Oh, that's lovely.
Because it's true to life. It is true to life. And to put it bluntly, I would like to feel love, express love, connect with other human beings more than being up here alone, mm-hmm.
So you mentioned Michael Krauss and Professor Scarland. What other professors did you have then, or teachers?
Well, I had the ones in the education department, and the reason I mentioned these are the two that influenced my life. Mm-hmm. They influenced the way I think. They took me from not really knowing how to be a student and made me into a student. So these are the ones I really want to mention. I mean, I could mention one, Atamian. He was in psychology. He was a wild man. And it was a big lecture hall. And he would prance this way, and he would prance that way, and I would just like almost get like there, and I'd just be watching him. And it was a big class. And all of a sudden he stopped, and he said, You are just staring at me. What are you doing just staring at me? Stop it right now." And I thought, God, okay. Okay, then I just looked down. But I thought, whoa. We each had a number in that class. And it was the only class. Every place else, they all knew you by your first name. But he had us each with a number. We took our first exam. And so I looked at the top because I was going to be the top. You know, so I looked at the top because I thought, I'm sure I got them all right. Because psychology is not what I would call a very difficult subject matter. And I looked up there, my name wasn't there. And I thought, I mean, my number wasn't there. And I thought, this can't be. This just can't be. So I looked a little farther down, and 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 down. I thought, oh, my God, what did I do wrong? All the way, way, way down at the bottom. And I thought, well, I missed it. So I just went backwards and read it backwards, you know, kind of like Chinese or something. You know, I read a different direction. And I wasn't there. So I was reading across in every which way. And it wasn't there. And I was so upset. So I stayed after class. And I said, Dr. Atamian, I'm really concerned. I said, I took that exam. But my number isn't up there. He said, I know. I know Susan Klingner. And he didn't know my name. He said, I know Susan Klingner. Your name was not up there because I grade on a curve. And your paper was so high, it would have messed up the whole curve. And I thought, well, maybe Dr. Atamian isn't so bad. I'll take him. So that was Dr. Atamian. But he had a temper. And all the students knew it, that he had a horrible temper. So Engineer's Day came. And I thought, I'm going to go over to see what they've done to Atamian because I'm sure they've done something. And so I went over there and I opened up the door and they had filled up the entire hallway in front of his office with chairs so he could not get out of his office. And he was, in his temper, he was screaming and yelling about us office students, you know, to let him out of his room. So, and you know, I just kind of, and I thought, well, I could start, I could be really nice and start moving the chairs. I don't think I'll do it. And I just let him scream and holler. You could probably hear him all over the university. Anyway, so I left him there. That engineering day was unbelievable. My really close friend who lived right across the hall from me on second floor in McIntosh Hall was Karen Wattle. She is now Bullard. And there was this horrible explosion, this boom. And Karen ran out of her room into my room and I said, what happened? And she said, something just blew out all the, you know, my window. But I was sleeping with the cover over my head, so I'm okay with this glass all over the floor. Well, so March 17th? They had blown out quite a few windows in the university because they didn't mean to. They just wanted to wake us all up with a big boom. But they really overdid that big boom.
For St. Patrick's Day?
For Engineering Day. You know, that's what they do on St. Pat's. They do horrible things. Okay, so then, you know, by this time, you know, you stand up and you think you have to use the restroom. So Karen and I ran down to the restroom and I was in one stall and she was on the other and she went, she got up first and she said, did you see what happened in the toilets? And I said, no. And she said, well, stand up and look. And I turned around and looked. When the urine would hit the water, it turned green. So it's green. So then we went outside on the campus and the engineers had taken a car of one of the professors, and they had turned over this car, and they set it on fire. I thought, you know, wait, this is just a little bit, I mean, maybe a little too extreme, even though we all love engineers. You know, my father being an engineer, I'd have to say that. So, but they were so wonderful. What they had done is he just had like an old junker car, and they brought him that new car, you know. But now, McIntosh Hall was wonderful, because we could do anything we wanted in it. And we decorated our rooms, our doors, did anything. In the winter, you know how depressing it can get, and a lot of people get more stationary. They don't want to go out. They get depressed. But I knew even then, that exercise brings you up. So I would do things to try to make the people happy. I would stick like one foot on one side of the wall and one foot on the other, and I'd wiggle my toes and go way up to the ceiling with my book and read my book. So when the girls would come out, literally climbing the walls. The other thing I did is I borrowed a bicycle and I'd ride up and down in the hallway. They just really gave us a lot of freedom that way. Mm-hmm. And I also went outside every day, regardless of what the temperature was. So one time I went out, it was 68 below. I did not realize that they had closed the university because I never missed a class. I never did. And the same way when I was teaching, mm-hmm. I never missed a class the whole year. So I went to class, and of course the building was shut up and everything was shut, so I came back in and I walked in the dormitory, and the students started laughing. And I said, "What is so funny?" They said, "Look in the mirror." I looked in the mirror, and exactly half my nose looked exactly like an ice cube. It had like started to freeze that fast. And I thought, oh no, if that nose turns black and falls off. But it didn't. Thank goodness. But I have to admit, I thought, I shouldn't be so much into myself, but I really don't want to go with a rubber nose around, you know.
You mentioned that they locked the doors every night. What time?
Yes, they did. Curfew was usually at 10:30. Mm-hmm. They locked the doors. And I must tell you about this, too. The student ratio to males and females was not balanced at all. Mm-hmm. So I think, if I remember correctly, there were 3 males to every female. So any place you went, you know, men came over to you. So I would go to the library to do my research. And if I sat down, well, then there would be like a man on either side or what have you. And it's very hard because they want to talk to you. So I mentioned it to Dr. Krause. He said, "Susie, you can have my office. Just go in my office." He shared an office with Dr. Krejci, both of them in linguistics. So Dr. Krause had tapes for me to listen to, like it was the Bereshit, which is like Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz ve'aretz ha-yata tohu ve'vohu v'choshek al pnei tachom v'ruach Elohim merachefet al pnei ha-mayim. Okay. This is the way it's sounding. So here I am listening to this, and here's poor Dr. Krejci trying to do whatever he wanted to do. Do you think I noticed him? No, because I focused. I focused only on that tape. Suddenly Dr. Krejci got up and he said, "I'll just go do all my work at home. You can just have this office." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize this was bothering you." He said, "You didn't realize this was bothering you? How many hours have you been listening to Bereshit bara Elohim?" So anyway, so he left and I had this office. So it was wonderful. So I would come to their office, which was now kind of usurped by me, and I would study in there and do my papers and different things I had to do. So, and I never noticed at the time. I never used a watch, never anything. And I was just studying and studying and studying. And then I was finished and I was going back to the dormitory. They had turned off all the lights in the library because their office was in the library, and I was locked in the library. And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? They did not have cell phones then. So I just started screaming and screaming and screaming, and eventually the night watchman heard me and came and let me out. So then I went back to McIntosh Hall. Well, they had locked the doors. So then I had to wake up somebody in the dorm, you know, banging and making noise to let me in. Well, they had a dorm council of various students to see what my punishment would be for coming in after the door was locked. So I explained to them I was just in the library, locked. These women said, "Oh, come on. You were locked in the library? This is the worst story we have ever heard. You had to be out probably having sex with some man." I said, no, I'm just a virgin. I mean, I just came here to study. I did not come here to catch a man. I want to study. And then I want to go around the entire world. This is my interest. And they said, oh, sure. We have been keeping record, and you have more dates than any woman in McIntosh Hall. I said, yes, but I'm never with one man long enough with all these dates to get that intimate. I said, I truly was studying. You can ask the night watchman, and that'll solve the problem. Oh, you probably know the night watchman. So, you're grounded. Instead of 10:30, you have to be in at 10 every night. I said, I can't be in at 10. I have a class that does not get out until later, and I'm missing already 10 minutes of my last class because I went to night school, mm-hmm. and I went to school in the morning, and in the afternoon I worked 6 hours in order to be able to pay my way through school. I did not want any debt, and I graduated with no debt that way. So that was terrible. I was taking the history of Alaska. And I needed that 3 hours for my degree. But they told me, if you do not come in, you would be kicked out of the dormitory. Well, the dorms were full. Where I'd have to live off campus. Well, this is ridiculous. I was already paying my way through school. I simply could not have done that. I had no car. You know, I just used the little public transportation, which was a bus, mm-hmm. or walked. Mm-hmm. Or skied. Mm-hmm. And I should tell you about the skis. The skis I bought were very, very old when I bought them. At least 35 years older, so back from 64. Big, thick, mm-hmm. wide ones, wooden, with a pair of very used, very hard leather boots that you had to strap in. But we'll leave the fact that I had to be in early. And I'll tell you what I loved was that loop around the university. And so I would strap those skis on me and do the, I think it was 6 miles around the university and do that. And then sometimes bear would cross like right in front of me and go to the dump, mm-hmm. the Alaskan, like the Fairbanks University's dump. Because, you know, cafeteria has a lot of extra food. And sometimes I would just see a little trail and just go off into the tundra, you know, off and ski that way. And one time I followed this trail way out, quite a distance to this cabin, and had such a wonderful adventure visiting with the person who lived in the campus, you know, in that cabin way out nowhere. And then turned around and started coming back. And it started snowing. And I realized the snow would cover up my tracks. And I had not marked the trail in any way, just following these tracks to the cabin. And I could have, I think, won an Olympic record for skiing. I went so fast. And finally, I thought I saw the... And the snow was covering the trail until you couldn't see the trail in front of you. And I looked up, and it looked like through the trees, maybe it was clear ahead. So I went out, and it was the loop. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, dangerous. I didn't have a compass. I didn't have anything. I'm not Dr. Scarlin, who said he used to put on skis and go 40 miles. But he knew how to kill a fat grouse. I mean, he could make himself a spear, and he'd tell me how you just sneak up under an evergreen tree and there's a fat grouse, and you just spear it up, and you've got yourself dinner. Well, I thought, you know, first of all, I don't want to kill a fat grouse. And I think I'll just stick more to the trails, you know. Yeah.
So things. What happened in the resolve of the residents then?
In the resolve of the residents, I really, truly, I was so angry because I was an honors student and I had received a rose in the rose ceremony. That ruined it because I had to leave class early, quite early, to get back to the dorm to be locked in. And then I would miss all that lecture every time we had a class. And it dropped me down to a C in that class. Mm-hmm. And so, no, that wasn't very good. But you know what? One of the girls on that committee was Randy Chase, my good friend. And I thought, well, why didn't she trust me? But she didn't. I guess she, you know. But she and I are still friends, and we still communicate with each other. And we have met each other on several different continents. We met each other when she worked for an import-export place in London. Mm-hmm. We met when she was teaching at the University of Ankara in the Peace Corps. I went there and spent time with her. And, of course, we met here. Mm-hmm. So it was nice. Yeah. I forgave her. I forgave her because our perceptions of people will never be perfect. Mm-hmm. And I know that. They will never be perfect. You know, we think this person is this way, but they aren't. Mm. You know. Yeah. But that helps you in getting along in the world to know that just remember this is only your perception of this person over here. Shut your mouth and listen to them say who they are and allow through their actions for you to see if even what came from their mouths really say who they are. In other words, look at what they do and how they act. Then make your judgment. And do it if you have firsthand knowledge, not second or third. So, yeah.
And when you were up here, did your parents come and visit you at all?
Yes, when I graduated. My parents came, and they stayed in one of the hotels in Fairbanks. And my mother heard this noise, and she looked out the window, and here was this man, this drunk man, with a whip going down the center of the street saying, "Mush, mush, mush." And she said, "But where was the dog sled?" And she said, she turned to my father and said, "If I had known that this place was like this, I'm not sure I would have agreed that my little Susie could have come up here." But, you know, but my mother, I'm like my mother a lot, and my mother is truly a person who loved being. And when her father passed away, that wonderful grandfather I mm-hmm. told you about that I had loved so much, he had left her a substantial amount of money. So she told my father, "I've decided what I'm going to do with this money." And he said, "Well, are you going to give it to a university, or what are you going to do?" She says, "I am going to go to Turkey along the Turkish-Iraqi border and visit the Kurds." And Dad said, "You're going to do that? Well, I'm not sure I'm going to do that." She said, "Did I ask you to do it?" She said, "You realize this is my money, this is my life, and I'm going out with the Kurds." And I thought, oh, yes, I know where I got to be the person I am. It was from my mother.
And
I'm going to tell you, yes, I'm going to tell you her name. Belle, which, of course, means beautiful in French, and she was a beautiful person. Belle Louise Klingner. And she went out with the Kurds, and my dad was so afraid to let her go by herself, he went with her. And the Kurds loved her. So now, my mother passed away in 2013. And I thought, well, I'll be a part of the Geno 2 National Geographic study because I want to know a little bit about our deep lineage, my mother's. And since I'm female, I would do that side. Well, what does it say about this deep part of my genes? Related quite a bit to Bedouin. You know, like the nomadic people. Upper Egypt, over into Saudi Arabia, all along that whole area in the Middle East, you know, and I had lived over in there, and I had, when I was there, gone out with the Bedouin. And loved the time with me. I rode a little donkey or something out way out in the Judean desert, and spent time with a Bedouin. And I thought, oh, I didn't know I was doing like my roots. And then the lineage, of course, went up through Lebanon. There was a branch that went off into Yemen, and but mine went up into Northern Europe, which would certainly explain my light eyes and skin. And then for the more recent time, I was most closely related to people who lived in present-day Germany and in present-day British Isles. Now, but I had all this other lineage in me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So that brought me all the way back to, that is my path.
Mm-hmm.
All the way back here. I consider this my golden anniversary.
It's 50
years. 50 years.
And
here.
Is this the first time you've been back?
I have been to Alaska before.
Mm-hmm.
But each time that I came, I wanted to see a part I had not seen before. Then, after the 50 years, I was driven. I wanted to see what had happened here. I wanted to see the library's growth because I felt we needed a better library so much. And I love the library now. I wanted to see all the research areas. I had loved the Geophysical Institute and everything. I had... In order to have a degree of normalcy, not just to be a student, I had babysat for many of the peoples who worked in the Geophysical Institute, their children. So Dr. Gotas, he was married to Sylvia Gotas. They had children, Nora and Tor. I babysat for them. Nora was just a little baby, and she had not even stood up and walked yet, but she could sit, and I would build a pyramid with blocks. And she would look at me, and she would build an exact duplicate pyramid. I thought, a very smart baby,
mm-hmm.
Very, very smart. And Dr. Gota said, now you look a lot like my wife, Sylvia, but do not open your mouth. Because when she hears you speak, she will know you're not speaking in our tongue, and she will scream. See, isn't that interesting? So the child could tell whether you were in which language.
Mm-hmm.
And Tor himself, he was around 10 or so, and he could really ski. You know, they knew how to do that. A man who was studying for his doctorate was Dr. Westcott. I mean, he became Dr. Westcott. He graduated in 64 with his PhD, and I went to his,
mm-hmm.
party, graduation party. He had, at that time, Brian, and I fell in love with that baby. I was really, truly like a mother. I mean, because when I graduated from the University of Alaska, I had like pains that I miss little Brian. I missed him so much. I would be studying on the couch or something, and he would come over, and he would pull down the book and look at me and smile, and I would say, what difference does study? It just doesn't matter. And I put it down, and I play with him because I just loved him. I loved him. And Dr. Westcott's wife, she was in studying anthropology. She had a smile always. And somehow that went over to that baby.
Mm.
Such a happy baby. So, and I love that. And I babysat for several others. We did have tragedies. I don't want you to think that everything was perfect. There was a tragedy in the linguistics area. One of the professors took his life. And my sister was getting married. I had gone back to Illinois for her wedding. And one of the wives of one of the professors for whom I babysit, one that I'm not mentioning, but she had called. My father had answered the phone. And he said, this woman from Alaska wants you to come back. because she is so sad. One of the professors she knew had committed suicide. And he said, but surely you're not going. And I said, the minute that is over, I'm coming back to be with her to take her to that funeral, because it would be so hard for her to go to the funeral. I went to the funeral. It was almost like she was weak in her knees, like how she could get up. And I held her and to walk down, you know, to the front and past the casket. Dr. Kraus saw me there, though I didn't realize. I wasn't noticing anybody else. I was just attending to this woman who was in grief. She was not his wife, but she knew him well. And later, Dr. Kraus told me, he said, you know, you were a student that was just like a mediocre student to me, just another student. I hadn't really noticed you. When I saw you comforting this woman, I changed, and I think there's more to you than I thought was to you. And after that, he gave me so much attention in helping me learn. It was amazing. I mean, the amount of time that he spent with me to bring me up to a higher level. So this is the way it is. It's like everywhere there is in the world. But freezing coldness, tragedies, fun, adventurous times, it all gives you a fuller picture, makes your life richer, and you learn from everything. You learn from tragedy. You learn from horrific experiences that may occur to you throughout your life. Mm-hmm. But when you have a good, stable background, it allows you to get through anything that might come up to you to face during life. So I can thank the University of Alaska for preparing me for a greater world, sometimes a very dangerous world, but it gave me tools to be able to face your environment, right, whatever it might be. Wherever you are.
You had mentioned, too, that you work 6 hours a day.
Yes, I did.
What job did you have?
And okay, how, now my jobs. Now you have to realize, what kind of background would I have? Just a regular life, going through high school, grade school, so forth. What kind of skills would I have? Number one, don't give me anything that has to do with secretarial skills. I do not want to file. I do not want to type. I do not want to do anything like that. That is 100% not Susie Klingler. No. But I did, my father always said, have more than one thing you can do, and don't be afraid to get your hands dirty. In other words, do whatever it takes to get where you want to do, and maybe do something that isn't academic so you have a balance. You have to know what a laborer does. You have to know what a scholar does. You have to know all of these different things in life. So I thought, okay, I have to look to see where is there a need. Okay. I was babysitting, and, you know, I would feed the children, and I opened up an oven. That was the filthiest thing I'd ever seen in my life. That was absolutely filthy. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I can start this business. I will clean ovens. And I mean, I had more work than you could ever think to do. It was like everybody on campus. It was like every graduate couple that were here and every like professor, and just like everybody wanted their ovens cleaned. So I cleaned all of these ovens. But I made enough money to go through school. You know, it worked. It worked for me. Oh, then, you know when I'm talking about labor?
Yes.
I want to mention Elnora Kelczewski. Okay. She was what you would call the maid in McIntosh Hall, the person who comes and cleans the toilets and does the dirty work. Well, Karen Waddell and I got very upset because we felt that some of the other students did not treat her as well as they should, like she was beneath them. And she wasn't. She was our equal. She was a fellow human being. So Karen said to some girls who were dirtying the sinks, "Do you know, Elnora, just clean these sinks. When you finish using them, would you mind cleaning them out, please? There's no reason why she should have to come back and do this again." And they said, "Well, that's what she's paid for, you know." And Karen says, "Okay, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to clean all these sinks. We are not going to leave this for Elnora again." And I thought, what a wonderful example. "Well, I'll help you, Karen. We're going to clean these sinks. We're not going to leave these sinks dirty for her." Elnora came in and she saw that and she said, "Thank you. I want to invite you out to where I live." So out we went. It was wonderful. The Boondocks, really. I mean, they had come down on a raft or something, and they had this little thing they had built that they lived in, and it was, the father was deceased, and it was the mother, Elnora, and her brothers, and they were, I guess what you would say, living the way people did 100 years prior to this. If they wanted ice, they had a sled, and they went down to a pond, and they cut out the big blocks of ice, and they brought it back, and they had a big black kettle, and they melted the ice for water. They shot moose, and they made their own moose jerky, and I became like almost a moose jerky addict. I loved it, loved it. And they'd give me this moose jerky that I could gnaw on when I was studying, and then I did not gain, you know, pounds and pounds of fat like the others who were eating other things. I ate that moose jerky. But to see how they lived in a totally natural way, roughing it and surviving, and they were surviving.
Amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, that was a woman for many years with whom I corresponded to. But then eventually I did not. I'm assuming, you know, the brothers and she, maybe they married or they moved or whatever. They had come in from Canada. They were Canadians originally. But at that time, you could just, you know, sit down on a piece of ground virtually and homestead it, and it could be yours. So that, I'm sure, is one reason why they came. But anyway, that was Elnora. Huh. So we think about Elnora.
So when you finished at UAF, you said you went back to where you're from and started teaching?
I left here and I went back to my hometown, Quincy, Illinois. Mm-hmm. At that time, they were starting a brand new program that had never been in the public school systems. And it was something that I had not studied. But you know how I always, I'm willing to try something new. I had not ever had a course in any of this. But it was special education. And they called it at that time, my level would be trainable. And they would have Down syndrome and brain damage. At that time, they had us separate, in a separate building than the regular school, but next to it. The children, you know, they thought, the administrators thought, oh, well, they shouldn't go to the regular cafeteria to get their food. They shouldn't go to the regular playground when the other kids are on it. And I had to fight, and I was on TV locally, to fight for these children that, yes, they can do what anyone would do in a public school system. So we went down and we played baseball, you know, with the others, and I got them to go to the cafeteria and get their trays and eat, because I felt like just because a person has what we call a little bit higher IQ, that doesn't mean that these other human beings should have less. So I did that for some years, and but then, as I told you, I taught many different things over the years. I did not stay in Quincy, Illinois.
I'm just going to change the tape and find out where you went to after that, okay?
Okay.